What we do know, what appears to be the situation, is that Gorbachev has been ousted from office, as the Soviets would have us believe, for his health's sake. How convenient it would be for his opponents if that turned out to be the realistic reason. He wasn't well, so the vice president takes over. The true story, in all likelihood, is a far more tangled and mysterious web. Are we witnessing the unscrambling of the egg, the return of the genie into the bottle? Is this to be the death knell of the newly found or the promised openness and freedom? Is this the first day of the turning back of the clock in that benighted country? Is glasnost and perestroika to be buried? We don't know. It is, of course, the story of the world this morning. The story, and we're going to be following it on top of it from as many perspectives as possible for the following 4 hours, and of course throughout the day, right here on KABC. I had, of course, planned to return from vacation this morning with a full slate of issues to tackle and guests to meet. I think, understandably, all have been cancelled or postponed until another time. Anyway, this morning the subject, the crisis in the Soviet Union. What do you think? If you have thoughts, comments, or questions, our phone number, 1-800-222-KABC, 1-800-222-KABC. Mortimer Zuckerman's on the line from his car. He's the man who owns, he's the editor-in-chief of U.S. News and World Report. He's in Manhattan. Could this have been anticipated?
Yes, well, it was clear that Gorbachev was failing dramatically at home in terms of delivering an economic standard of living that was viable. The economy was sinking at an alarming rate. His political base was shrinking. And the result of that is that the hard right, the right wing there, the fascist, what I would call the rational murderers, became concerned, because if they lose their jobs, they not only lose their jobs, it's not as if they retire and join some company or go on a board of directors. They lose their home, they lose their health benefits, they lose education and travel for their children and for themselves. I mean, they lose everything, and their lives themselves may be threatened, because if in a popular election, which was scheduled for next year, the Communist Party is thrown out of office, which undoubtedly they would have been, there would have been inquiries into what these people have been doing, which is called crimes and murders, for decades. So I think they were desperate people looking for desperate means. The key now, over the next several days and several weeks, is what happens to the workers. If the workers in all of the major and secondary cities go out on general strike, which of course is what Yeltsin has called for, then their choice will be whether or not they fold or they fire on their own people. And that will be the key test of what happens. If they fire on their own people, they may be able to retain power in the short run, but sooner or later that's going to be a complete disaster. A civil war there would be the end of the Soviet Union.
Mortimer Zuckerman is in the car on the way back from the airport into Manhattan. Can I triangulate here and join you with Beijing, China?
Yes.
And somebody I think you know quite well, Professor Marshall Goldman.
Oh, yes, of course.
Professor Goldman, good very early Tuesday morning to you.
Thank you.
I don't know if you just heard what Mortimer Zuckerman's saying.
Did.
He's in his car on the way into Manhattan. How are the Chinese being told about what's happening?
Well, they was on their news program, their evening news program. It was the third item, but some of my Soviet friends have very mixed emotions about this, because some of my friends are liberals and they were hoping that the Soviet reforms would succeed. The fact that they failed is going to make basically reinforce the hardliners here, who say, see, there but for Gorbachev go I.
And how far do you think is Gorbachev going to go? I mean,
well, I think Gorbachev's gone.
You've been saying this to me, it was going to happen for over a year.
Well, I had predicted it would be March 91, so I'm off by about 6 months, but I think he's gone. Yeltsin is a different question. Yeltsin has a mandate. Gorbachev doesn't have a mandate, and I think people blame Gorbachev for the chaos that's hit the Soviet Union. It's Yeltsin who's called for the general strike, and whether or not they can pull it off remains to be seen. I must say, standing just outside Tiananmen Square here does not bode well for one's imagination of what might happen. I'm prepared to believe that the Soviet troops will use violence. Maybe not the first ones in, but the first ones in Tiananmen Square didn't use violence either.
Well, Marshall, any comment to that?
Well, yes, I think Marshall's absolutely right. Undoubtedly, they will try and find troops who are prepared to fire. But even if they do find those troops, I have a feeling that, unlike China, so much has happened in the Soviet Union, so much openness, democracy, reform has already taken place, that to put that genie back in the bottle is going to be a much different challenge for any Soviet government there than it would have been in China, where you had largely a peasant population that really was indifferent to a large degree to reforms at the center. In the Soviet Union, however, the cooperation of the workers is going to be so critical that if they go out on strike and there is firing on them, the conditions which Marshall referred to, the chaotic conditions, are going to get much worse even more rapidly. And in a condition of that kind of chaos, it's really hard to predict what will happen. Nobody really knows. But I do agree, A, Gorbachev is gone, and B, whoever succeeds him, if it is on the right wing, is going to have a very tough challenge. If it isn't Gorbachev, it seems to me it's got to be somebody like Yeltsin on the other side of the coin who has some popular support. Of course, there are people who are in the middle who will sort of be a bridge between the two of them, like Arkady Bolsky, the head of the sort of enterprise managers, factory managers, and the big major industrialists in that country. And they may be able to bridge some kind of agreement between them, but it's going to be a very dicey situation for a period of time.
I'd agree, but I'm prepared to believe that the purge will take place, that anybody who's been too outspoken is going to be in great difficulty, that they're going to use troops rigorously, and that this has been a very carefully orchestrated procedure. They've announced that they're going to take over control of the media, and that was Yeltsin's strength, that he could go around Gorbachev, he could appeal to the population through television and through local press.
Right.
My understanding is that they're going to take over the press now, and this is going to give them a very effective control and going to make it very difficult for any organized resistance to gather strength.
Is it possible?
Michael, I have to excuse myself, but I'll speak with you later if I may.
I'd love it. I'll call you later on.
Thanks.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Mortimer Zuckerman in Manhattan. Still on the line and generous with his time. I appreciate it very much. Marshall Goldman, who's in Beijing, China.
And I should say, waiting for my new book to come out, which is called What Went Wrong with Perestroika, The Rise and Fall of Mikhail Gorbachev.
Well, have we seen the first nail in the coffin of glasnost and perestroika?
I'm afraid so.
Really?
You and I have talked for a long time, and I always insisted that it was not impossible that the genie could be put back in the bottle, or at least a good portion of the genie, just as they did here in Tiananmen Square. So I think that's still a possibility.
The Vice President, Yanayev, announced earlier this morning that he's taken over, as President, but he said it will take time for Gorbachev's health to improve.
It'll take a long time. People were saying before, those who thought that I was just off base, said, Gorbachev has a five-year term, he can't be removed, the Soviet military has never done anything like this. They were wrong on both accounts. Gorbachev could always announce that his health forces him to resign, and if he doesn't announce it, somebody else can announce it,
but that's
exactly what happened.
Why would Yanayev say that he expects that Gorbachev will resume his duties and that they would work together? Is that just puffery?
Well, this is one way to hold off the opposition. Michael, I'm going to have to run, too.
Okay. Thank you very much indeed. Good day to you. So, everybody's running today, I'm glad to say. It's early a.m. Tuesday morning in China. That's Marshall Goldman. He's visiting in Beijing, China, speaking to us from the ABC Bureau there. He, of course, runs the Russian Research Center at Harvard. Let's go over to Bonn, Germany. Newsweek Bureau Chief there, Michael Mayer. Could the Germans have anticipated this, Michael?
Well, I think so. People have been worried about whether Gorbachev could survive for some time now. It began last summer with the talk of hardline opposition to Gorbachev's reforms, and speculation that he was growing weaker has grown through the last year. The German Foreign Office has always taken great pains to make the point that its policies and the West policies toward the Soviet Union, that is greater openness, greater acceptance, wasn't contingent on one man staying in power. They didn't depend on Mikhail Gorbachev.
Mm-hmm.
Now comes the test as to whether that's true or not.
Interesting, though. Without that one man, that war might well still be there.
Well, it certainly will. I'm going to meet later this week with the man named Egon Krenz, who
mm-hmm.
defeated Erich Honecker, who was responsible for opening the wall in November of 1989. And he told me last year that he certainly wouldn't have been able to do it had Mikhail Gorbachev not only created the climate in which the wall was obsolete, but actually came to Berlin and told Erich Honecker that life rewards those who are flexible, and those who are inflexible and do not change with the times tend to perish, he said.
Well,
within weeks, Erich Honecker was out of power.
I was going to say, because nobody from the Soviet Union has been more flexible, surely, than Mikhail Gorbachev. Now we're going to go back to the inflexibles. If that is so, what impact do the Germans foresee this possibly having on Europe? I mean, it surely isn't going to reinstate the Warsaw Pact. You can't take back the Poles, the Czechs, the Hungarians, the Albanians, the Bulgarians. They're not going to return to the fold, surely.
Well, and surely you're right. The tanks aren't going to roll into Eastern Europe again. Soviet troops have pulled out of Czechoslovakia. They're gone from Hungary. They never were in Bulgaria, Romania, and they certainly won't go there now that they're democracies. So you're right. An Iron Curtain is not going to descend, dividing Europe once again. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, the Germans, like everyone else, are very, very worried. What if, for example, the Yugoslav army, run by communists, very conservative, uses this occasion when the world's attention is focused on Moscow to crack down in the breakaway republics of Slovenia and Croatia? You would have, in effect, a European war there. And it's very possible that will happen. It's also possible that conservative regimes in Bulgaria and Romania, military or simply civilian communist, will use the use what happens in Moscow as a test of their own ability to seize power. So it's, yes, Czechoslovakia is gone and Hungary is gone and Poland is gone, but democracy is less of a sure thing in other countries. It's not impossible that we could go backwards.
Did the German press get the story in time to make it the banner headline this morning?
No, it didn't at all. This broke this morning and everybody missed it. Of course, it's dominating the airwaves now. Nobody can talk of anything else. People stand in the streets to talk about it. People, the television is full of speculation about what this means and is Gorbachev alive and who's in power. None of these questions at this point can really be answered.
I haven't heard anybody else.
All we know is that we have passed an historic point.
I've not heard any other correspondent or anyone say, is Gorbachev alive? So then when he stepped down or was ousted for health reasons, it might be for future health reasons.
Well, I don't mean anything untoward. Certainly no. Gorbachev is not going to be popped off. But there was some speculation this morning that perhaps Gorbachev did indeed have a heart attack. That would have been incredibly convenient for the hardline faction, but you couldn't rule it out. No, it looks like Gorbachev is going to be held under house arrest for some time, but times have changed in the Soviet Union. How long can they arrest this man? How long can they hold him incommunicado? And what happens when he does speak, if he's allowed to? Can he command the popularity of the Soviet Union that he could face down this challenge? My personal feeling, and the feeling of most Germans here, is that however popular Gorbachev is in the West, and he's very popular in the West, he's not at all popular at home, and people are not going to arise on his behalf.
Thank you very much indeed for giving us that assessment. Look forward to what you write on the matter.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Good day to you. So that's the bureau chief in Bonn, Germany, for Newsweek magazine. That's Michael Mayer. So the surprise leadership switch in the Soviet Union could mean a reconfiguration of policy toward the only country capable of delivering nuclear destruction to the United States. And that will be not just in this country, but in, as we've heard, Europe and elsewhere.
In vast parts of the city, people are basically going on about their business. The only other somewhat unusual thing that I noticed was that the lines at gas stations are even longer than usual.
Now, Boris Yeltsin has called for resistance. He's calling for a general strike. What are other politicians there saying?
Well, Edward Shevardnadze, the former foreign minister, is having a press conference starting, I believe, in just a few minutes. I believe the mayor of Moscow, I don't know precisely what he said, but he also apparently spoke this morning supporting Yeltsin's statement. You know, obviously there are people who are not going to just lie down and let this happen. But, you know, beyond Yeltsin's call for a general strike at this moment, I think that's the most important opposition voice at this point, and we'll have to see what happens as a result of that.
And yet the committee running the country now includes the KGB and the military. Is resistance a plausible idea here?
Well, armed resistance is not, obviously. If in fact, the military, if the army, the rank-and-file soldiers go along with and obey the orders of this committee. But, you know, let me remind you of what happened in Lithuania in January when there was a terrible show of force by the military, and the Lithuanian people, with civil disobedience, essentially, you know, forced the military to back down. There was bloodshed. 15 people died in Lithuania in January. And, of course, we don't know exactly, you know, what happened, who gave what order, but at some point after that bloodshed and the worldwide reaction condemning that, you know, eventually the military backed down. Now, you know, as I say, there's in Moscow, people seem stunned more than anything at this point. There were some demonstrators down by the Kremlin. It's hard to say what will happen. Will more people go down there? Will they try to arrange some kind of vigil to try to stand up to this military force? It's not clear. Boris Yeltsin, of course, has no army of his own. The other Soviet republics do not have their own armies. They cannot put up any kind of military fight. If there's to be resistance, you know, there could, of course, be armed resistance in some places, perhaps in Armenia, perhaps in Georgia's southern republics of the Soviet Union. But on a wide scale, I think the only, you know, the only really feasible means of resistance is passive civil disobedience, as Yeltsin was calling for today.
NPR's Ann Cooper in Moscow. Joining us now is NPR's Ted Clark. Ted, President Bush met with reporters at his vacation home in Kennebunkport, Maine, and called today's developments extra-constitutional.
That's right. The president does not think this was a constitutional transfer of power that just took place in Moscow. He called it a coup by the KGB and the military, and he said it's a very hardline group that seems to be calling the shots there. He said it could have serious consequences for the Soviet people and for the Soviet Union's relations with other countries, including the United States. He reminded people of the changes that President Gorbachev has already put in place, reminding us that this era of cooperation should continue, that Gorbachev was so pivotal in creating, and he said we do not want to see that era of cooperation change, obviously. He's been in touch with allied leaders already around the world. He's been in touch with Secretary of State James Baker and with the ranking American diplomat in our embassy in Moscow, and the president said all our people, I assume he means embassy staff people, are safe. And he said we'll follow events very carefully to determine what the United States response should be.
Does he think the coup is reversible?
Well, he thinks it might be. He said, remember, coups can fail when they run up against the will of the people. And he said he's convinced that the Soviet people want reform. And he said that with a coup like this, you never know what's going to happen. It's awfully early to say that the reforms that Mr. Gorbachev put in place are reversible.
Does the president know who's in charge?
Well, not really. Obviously, it's a hardline group, the president said, but as for who is actually the leader in the Soviet Union, the president said he didn't know. He said that American officials may contact the new leaders in the Soviet Union, but he doesn't want to do anything to confer legitimacy on these new leaders, whom he called extra-constitutional.
The United States and the Soviet Union have been involved in a lot of cooperative efforts here. What happens to those?
Well, the economic cooperation gets put on hold, the president said. Any talk of giving the Soviet Union economic aid or better trade benefits will be put on hold, but the president stressed that he wants the START treaty, the Strategic Arms Treaty, to go forward and be ratified by the Senate.
What about efforts toward a Middle East peace conference? Both were involved in that.
Well, it's very early to say what will happen with that. The president, I didn't hear the president comment on that directly today, but as you know, the peace conference is to be jointly sponsored by the United States and the Soviet Union. I don't know now whether that conference can go ahead as planned. Of course, there were lots of other uncertainties about that conference, and it was not at all certain that it was going to go ahead in October as hoped.
It's got to be a shocking thing for President Bush. He just had a summit with this man.
Oh, I think it was a shocking thing. He said he had no indication that this was coming. U.S. intelligence, of course, has been warning that such a thing was possible for some time, but he did not know it was going to happen. He was awakened last night, U.S. time, by his National Security Advisor, Brent Scowcroft, and given the news, everybody in the U.S. government, I think, has been caught by surprise.
Thank you very much. NPR's Ted Clark.
Russian Federation President Boris Yeltsin has denounced today's ouster of Soviet President Gorbachev, calling it a right-wing reactionary coup. Yeltsin says he is ordering the Russian Federation's government and people not to obey the new leadership. World leaders expressed shock at the Soviet developments. The change of leadership caught the White House by surprise. Hurricane Bob is moving up the Atlantic coast after pounding the Outer Banks of North Carolina. It is now aiming its 115-mile-an-hour winds at New England. And those are some of the top stories in the news.
Hundreds of military vehicles rolled through Moscow's streets today after a committee of military and communist hardliners seized control of the government. The Soviet military confronted demonstrators at two locations in central Moscow, but no injuries were reported. Armored vehicles surrounded the Russian Parliament building, where Russian Federation President Boris Yeltsin was among the demonstrators. The BBC's Tim Huell reports.
All around the Parliament building, people are beginning to build barricades. They've torn down wooden fences, broken branches off trees, and now they're bringing bricks from a nearby repair workshop, although it's not clear whether the bricks are for building up the defences or for throwing, if necessary, at approaching troops. The building of the barricades appears to be a spontaneous action. Parliamentary leaders say they've not ordered it, and officially the building is only guarded by a few armed policemen who appear loyal to Mr. Yeltsin's government, and by several vanloads of Russian Interior Ministry forces, who've taken up position in the inner courtyard. Armored cars are still standing along the bridge opposite the parliament, but they've not tried to approach the building since this morning, when Mr. Yeltsin climbed up on a military vehicle and read out his decree to the Russian people. It says the emergency committee is illegal, and Russian citizens can be punished for obeying it. But with the Russian Federation's TV channel now off the air, and Russian Federation newspapers unlikely to be published tomorrow, it's not clear how Mr. Yeltsin can get his message to the public. This morning, the Russian leader failed to make contact with Mr. Gorbachev and told journalists afterwards he believed all channels of communication were now in the hands of the leaders of the coup. Mr. Yeltsin said Muscovites should gather outside their parliament, but if anything, the crowd has thinned out since this morning. Tim Huell, BBC, at the Russian parliament.
Melar Sturua, a senior correspondent for the Soviet newspaper Izvestia, currently is a visiting professor at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. Sturua notes that this is not the first time a reform-minded Soviet leader has been ousted by hardliners. Nikita Khrushchev, who denounced the excesses of the Stalin years, was overthrown in a coup 27 years ago. He says the men who have ousted Gorbachev are not totally opposed to his economic and political reforms, but they believed that Gorbachev was going too far and that the hardliners saw their time was running out.
There are people who would like to defend socialism and socialist structure inside the Soviet Union, who prefer old economic system, and they want just to restructure socialist, to make socialism lean and mean without abandoning it.
Gennady Yanayev has declared himself president, but is he really in charge or is he a figurehead?
Well, I don't think that Mr. Yanayev is in charge because he didn't have his own power base before. He was handpicked by President Gorbachev when Gorbachev was elected by the Supreme Soviet president, and he picked him up as his vice president. So it seems to me that he, in a way, legitimizes this change because he was a vice president.
Did Gorbachev have no chance to fight back? Were there no supporters of his in Moscow that could have resisted this?
Well, I think that events are just unfolding. We don't know now how events will go further. It's just the very beginning, and everybody was surprised and taken by surprise. It seems to me that nowadays the forces of democracy are much stronger than during Khrushchev's times. At that time, of course, Khrushchev was hopeless when he was overthrown. Nowadays, because of perestroika, because of these 6 years of freedom, it seems to me it would be much more difficult to restore old-fashioned socialist regime. More than that, because the republics have now independence or are now very much involved in the fight for their own independence, it would be much more difficult to police the whole Soviet Union as before.
But the committee issued a statement this morning taking a very hard line toward the republics.
That's quite understandable, because they want to reverse the situation, and it wasn't coincidental that this coup appeared just on the eve of signing of new Union Treaty. Despite the fact that this treaty wasn't satisfactory enough, it was still a real danger for all centralized structures, because this treaty gave many freedoms and many advantages to the republics.
From the statements Boris Yeltsin is making today, one would suspect they might want to arrest him too. He's calling for a strike. He's calling for resistance to
yes.
what's going on.
Yes. The point is now there is a war of law, so to speak, because the new president now tries to implement the Soviet law throughout the Soviet Union, but the Russian parliament voted a new law which is above the Soviet law, which has priorities. And now, of course, in this situation, tanks are much more vocal than law and the justice. But at the same time, as I told you before, because of the 6 years of experience of relative freedom, it would be much more difficult to reverse this development. And there is another point. You can engineer a coup, but how can you solve all these almost insurmountable economic problems, nationalities problems, and other problems which are beyond the military solution?
Are you saying perestroika isn't necessarily dead?
No, it isn't dead, but there is a very serious setback, and it can be even bloody setback. But perestroika as such was dead before Mr. Gorbachev was overthrown. But the quest for democracy, the quest for freedom, is very much alive, and I'm very optimistic despite this very dangerous setback.
Melor Starua, a senior correspondent for the Soviet newspaper Izvestia, who currently is a visiting professor at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Jean Cochran. Soviet communist hardliners, backed by columns of tanks in the streets of Moscow, seized power today from President Mikhail Gorbachev. It happened while Gorbachev was on vacation in the Crimea. Reports say he has been detained there. Taking his place is his handpicked vice president, Gennady Yanayev. He now leads a state emergency committee that has imposed a 6-month state of emergency. The BBC's Tim Huell is in Moscow. He filed this report.
I can see armored personnel carriers lined up in a column, preventing any traffic from moving. Pedestrians are crowding round the armored cars, holding red, blue and white Russian banners, and it looks as though a demonstration is about to begin. Earlier, tanks drove right up to the Parliament building, and Mr. Yeltsin emerged to read out his new decree. It says the decisions of the emergency committee have no legal force on Russian territory, and all those who obey them can be punished under Russian law. Earlier, Mr. Yeltsin told a press conference in the debating chamber of the parliament he feared his government no longer had any means of informing the people about his decisions. He said Russian Federation newspapers would probably not be published tomorrow, and he appealed in particular to foreign journalists to convey his position to the world and to the Soviet Union.
The BBC's Tim Huell reporting from Moscow. Military action is also reported in other Soviet republics. In the breakaway Baltics, Soviet warships reportedly have blocked the main harbor in Estonia, and troops have silenced Lithuanian television and radio. President Bush expressed concern over the ouster of Soviet President Gorbachev this morning as he spoke to reporters in Kennebunkport, Maine. Alan Dowd of Maine Public Radio reports.
The president said the situation within the Soviet Union is still murky, but he said Gorbachev's removal from power was done outside of the Soviet Union's constitution.
Clearly, it's a disturbing development. There's no question about that. And it could have serious consequences for the Soviet society and in Soviet relations with other countries, including the United States.
The president called Gorbachev an historic figure. He said the Soviet people supported Gorbachev's reforms. He said the coup was only in its first stage and could be reversed. He said it will not be business as usual between the Soviets and Western countries, but he said there was little the U.S. could do but stay calm and follow the situation closely. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Kennebunkport.
Wall Street is reacting strongly to Gorbachev's ouster, plunging more than 100 points in early trading. Economist Robert Stovall says it may go down a little more before turning around.
The most, I think, the Dow Jones will be off 120, 130 points at the worst, and it'll probably happen here before lunchtime in New York. I'd say on the whole day, we'd be down somewhere between 50 and 100 Dow points.
Economist Robert Stovall, this is NPR. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 101.30 points at 2866.72 in active trading of 55 million shares. Financial markets around the world are in turmoil in reaction to the news from the Soviet Union today. It has caused the dollar and oil prices to soar and share prices to plunge. The dollar gained sharply against the mark and around 1 yen in Tokyo. Oil prices increased more than a dollar to their highest level since the Gulf War. And in Tokyo, share prices lost more than 1,300 points on the day, about 6%.
The crisis in the Soviet Union has prompted President Bush to interrupt his vacation in Maine. Today, the White House says the president will return here to Washington today for one day. News of the ouster of Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev was greeted with universal dismay by heads of government around the world, and there was a sense of nervousness as world financial markets opened this morning. From London, Michael Goldfarb reports.
The announcement of the coup against Mikhail Gorbachev took world leaders completely by surprise. President George Bush received the news around midnight at his holiday home in Kennebunkport, Maine. He spent much of the night consulting with National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft and other top advisors. Bush spoke to the press early this morning and called attention to the illegality of the coup.
This move was extra-constitutional, outside of the constitutional provisions for governmental change. Clearly, it's a disturbing development. No question about that. And it could have serious consequences for the Soviet society and in Soviet relations with other countries, including the United States.
Bush's thoughts were echoed by British Prime Minister John Major, who added a personal tribute to the deposed Soviet leader.
I hope there is no doubt in anyone's mind about the immense contribution that he's made over recent years, both to the prospects for people within the Soviet Union and for the rapprochement that has taken place between East and West as a result of his efforts and those of Presidents Reagan, Bush, and others.
In Germany, Chancellor Helmut Kohl returned to Bonn from vacation in Austria to set up a crisis committee to deal with the situation. There are still 330,000 Soviet troops in Germany, and there was immediate concern that the new Soviet leadership might renege on agreements for withdrawal of the Red Army from the former East Germany. However, a spokesman for the Soviet Armed Forces said the withdrawal of troops would continue as scheduled. In Brussels, NATO Secretary General Manfred Werner issued a statement saying this morning's events gave reason for great concern and added the Allies were monitoring the situation closely. The Political Committee of NATO held an emergency meeting. Speaking from his holiday home in Portugal, United Nations Secretary General Javier Pérez de Cuellar said he was very surprised by the news and hoped the political change in the Soviet Union would not have negative repercussions on the world situation. Japanese Prime Minister Toshiki Kaifu called an emergency meeting of his cabinet to assess the situation. As events moved at rapid speed in the Soviet Union, leaders from the industrialized countries were conferring with one another by telephone. When the news broke, the trading day was well underway in Asia, and it hit the financial markets there hard. In Tokyo, shares on the Nikkei Stock Exchange lost nearly 6% of their value. The dollar rose sharply against all Asian currencies. The dollar is traditionally seen as a safe haven by currency traders in times of crisis. A Tokyo Central Bank official said the group of seven industrial nations were ready to take joint action to stabilize the currency markets. News of the Gorbachev ouster also hit hard in Israel. Officials called an emergency meeting to assess the coup's impact on Soviet Jewish emigration to Israel. Currently, 60,000 Jews have exit visas and are ready to leave. The Israelis were preparing contingency plans to get as many of those people out as soon as possible. Yuri Gordon, head of immigration for the Jewish Agency, a quasi-governmental agency responsible for bringing Jews to Israel, said, "This is apparently the end of the Gorbachev period, and if a civil war is expected, the Jewish people will want to leave in very large numbers." I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Who is this man who has pulled the rug right out from under Mikhail Gorbachev? CNN's Mark Leff has this profile.
The name Gennady Yanayev was not a familiar one inside or outside the Soviet Union until the day 8 months ago when Mikhail Gorbachev tapped him as his deputy and heir to the political system he reshaped.
Vice-president, товарища Янаева, Геннадий Иванович.
At 54, Yanayev is half a dozen years younger than Gorbachev, but their political careers are remarkably similar. Yanayev was born in Gorky, east of Moscow, and like Gorbachev, is an ethnic Russian, as all Soviet leaders have been since Joseph Stalin. He trained as a historian and a lawyer, concentrating on international youth movements, worked in provincial politics, and at the national level with trade unions, international friendship societies, and the Communist Party Central Committee.
He never had really a power base. And he is the person virtually unknown almost to anybody in the Soviet Union.
His nomination came at a time of turmoil in Soviet politics. Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze, who'd been expected to get the vice presidency, had just resigned, loudly, denouncing Gorbachev's efforts to give the presidency greater powers and warning that dictatorship was coming. If you make a dictatorship, said Shevardnadze, who can say who will become the dictator? Yanayev, whom many viewed as a conservative compromise candidate, told the party Congress he was a communist from the bottom of his heart. Liberals weren't happy about what was happening.
He's a typical apparatchik, you know. It's a member of nomenklatura, brought up by the system, and whatever he says today, I don't believe a word.
I would personally feel that there may be danger of excessive concentration of power in the hands of president if somebody else may come to power.
Although Yanayev was the only candidate for vice president, the party Congress rejected him the first time it voted. Yanayev missed a majority by 31 votes out of more than 2,000. Gorbachev said Yanayev was committed to his policy of restructuring Soviet society.
I want someone alongside me I can trust.
Gorbachev did end up with most of the new powers he wanted, and Yanayev did end up as vice president.
It's very dangerous because such a man as Yanayev, I cannot imagine him as the leader of this country.
Gennady Yanayev, who calls himself a realistic radical, kept a relatively low profile after his election, not unlike vice presidents in many countries, though he has publicly worried about what will happen to people as the Soviet economy and the economies of its former communist neighbors in Eastern Europe move away from central planning and toward a free market system. Yanayev, who speaks English and German, represented the Soviet Union at the meeting last month that formally ended the Soviet-dominated Warsaw Pact military alliance, and said at the time he hoped the North Atlantic Treaty Organization wouldn't last much longer as what he called a Cold War organization. A few weeks later, his vice presidential duties as a ceremonial greeter had him meeting the President of the United States, who was in Moscow to sign an arms reduction treaty with Mikhail Gorbachev. Now, the word from Moscow is that Gennady Yanayev and George Bush are equals, with acting President Yanayev heading a new governing federal committee with powers far greater than Mikhail Gorbachev or George Bush have ever had. Mark Leff, CNN, reporting.
The TASS news agency says the defense ministry has ordered the tanks and troops that rolled into Moscow on Monday to withdraw. And TASS reports the chairman of the Supreme Soviet Legislature is flying to the Crimea to meet with President Mikhail Gorbachev there. At the same time, TASS says representatives of the U.S., France, Germany, and Britain are also headed to the Crimea. These follow reports that the eight coup leaders have fled Moscow and are also on a plane, this one headed for Soviet Central Asia. The reports say the Russian officials believe the plane is headed for Kyrgyzstan and will be intercepted and its passengers arrested. And the latest bulletin, this one from Reuters, says the emergency committee which seized power from Gorbachev has disbanded. No further details on that report. NPR's Ann Cooper in Moscow says it's difficult to tell if the coup has in fact collapsed, but she says there was an air of optimism outside the Russian parliament building this morning.
Both inside and outside the parliament building this morning, there was quite a bit of optimism. Part of it was just stemmed from the fact that people felt we survived one night under siege. They did not take us. We're still here. We're still fighting. We're still resisting.
There were confrontations between Soviet troops and Yeltsin supporters during the night. Four people were killed. Secretary of State James Baker welcomed reports from Moscow that the Soviet Union may be returning to constitutional government. In a statement issued on his arrival in Brussels for a NATO meeting, Baker said he cannot confirm all the reports, but he said it would appear events are moving in a positive direction. Israeli Housing Minister Ariel Sharon has urged all Jews in the Soviet Union to leave everything behind and go to Israel without delay. Israeli immigration authorities have been holding emergency planning sessions to deal with the inspected influx of new immigrants. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem.
Minister Sharon heads the Parliamentary Committee on Immigration, which held an urgent session this morning in the wake of the turmoil in the Soviet Union. After the meeting, Sharon said he believes Soviet Jews are in danger for their lives and should leave the country for Israel as soon as possible.
Every Jew that can do it now should leave Russia, can leave everything behind and save his life and be rescued in one place where Jews got the right to defend themselves, and that is in their homeland in Israel.
An estimated 60 to 80,000 Jews in the Soviet Union have visas to leave for Israel. Immigration officials in Moscow say there's been a rise in the number of requests for immigration papers and that so far Soviet authorities have made no moves to stop Jewish emigres. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
We're going very shortly to Kennebunkport, Maine, and a statement from President Bush. Here it is.
I wanted to report to the American people on some of the latest developments related to the situation in the Soviet Union. I spoke at length this morning to President Boris Yeltsin. Call began at about 8:30. And I also talked to Ambassador Strauss, who is now in our embassy in Moscow, in position. And I also talked in the last 20 hours to President Menem in Argentine, with Prime Minister Mulroney, Prime Minister Major, and I will continue these kinds of consultative calls. President Yeltsin was clearly encouraged by the fact that he had survived another night in the Russian Parliament building without a major assault by the forces supporting his coup. He told me that tens of thousands of Muscovites had turned out to help guard the building from attack. Yeltsin said he was encouraged by indications that more and more military units and their commanders were abandoning support of the coup. His building is still surrounded, however, and special troops, the Spetsnaz, are remaining loyal to the coup plotters. It is those troops who are moving to occupy additional sites in the Baltic states. President Yeltsin said that the Russian Supreme Soviet had met and declared unanimously that the coup was illegal and without effect. And he also mentioned the importance of the next meeting of the Union Supreme Soviet, which will be held on August 26th And they are, as way he put it, they are vigorously trying to line up support for that Supreme Soviet to declare this coup illegal. President Yeltsin said he told the Supreme Soviet of the strong support given by the United States to those resisting the illegal Emergency Committee activities, and that the Supreme Soviet received the news very, very warmly. There are at present, according to Yeltsin, flights of aircraft carrying his representatives and also others with members of the Emergency Committee on their way to the Crimea to meet with President Gorbachev. Obviously, he doesn't have all the details on that, and I won't be able to fill you in on any details on that either. Now, President Yeltsin said he was prepared for all contingencies. He thanked the United States profusely for its support, which was making an important difference, and asked that we continue to stay in touch with him, which we will do. Ambassador Bob Strauss, who had just arrived, gave me a rundown on developments in Moscow, which paralleled those of President Yeltsin, the reports he was getting there. Overall, while the situation remains highly fluid and uncertain, I think it is safe to say that the situation appears somewhat more positive than in the earliest hours of this coup. And so I will stay in touch with President Yeltsin, hopefully at some point be able to contact President Gorbachev, which we still are unable to do. But I guess I would say to the American people, these developments are positive.
Mr. President, this hardly sounds like a declaration the coup is over. What can you tell us based on your conversations with Yeltsin and any other information you've got about the status of the coup plotters, whether the Emergency Committee is still in control there, and the whereabouts and the condition on President Gorbachev?
We don't know. We have all kinds of rumors. We have all kinds of raw intelligence coming in. But Norm, I think it would be a big mistake to add to the rumor mill. We simply don't know. Yeltsin tells me that he thinks five of the coup leaders have left Moscow, but he, I think, would be the first to tell you that he is not totally certain on this. He also feels that Pavlov is in the hospital, and but we can't confirm it, and therefore it just, there's so much rumor and speculation. I want to try here now to avoid that as best I can.
Who's in control of the Soviet military right now, and were there any Western diplomats on these planes that are supposedly headed for the Crimea to meet with Gorbachev?
Well, there were rumors about a flight that was taking some Western diplomats from the embassies there. I talked to John Major about that, but there's no evidence that when I talked to him, which was 15 minutes ago, there was no, he'd confirmed that the plane had not left, and yet rumors had it that they were on their way. So he had just talked to his emissary who was going to be on the airplane.
Mr. President, could you elaborate? Have you tried to reach President Gorbachev since yesterday?
I haven't tried to get a direct phone call to him personally, but I'll keep trying.
If the Soviets survive this constitutional crisis, would you be more inclined to provide direct economic aid to their economy, which will be in no better shape?
We will look at it. The G7 took action on that. We will continue to do what both Gorbachev and Yeltsin want, and that is to provide the kind of aid that the G7 said they would provide. And we will certainly, if things work out in a satisfactory fashion, get back into the business of furthering the economic recovery, certainly. Yeah.
Could you elaborate a little bit on what you said about these special forces troops? The impression seems to have been that these were troops that were leaving the city. That was a positive sign. Is it your understanding?
There's two different groups of them. One of them is the airborne forces, and I believe that the airborne commander has come over to the Yeltsin side and pulled his forces back. The other are Spetsnaz forces, which are the highly disciplined forces who answer to Defense Minister Yazov, and apparently they are still under command of Yazov, and they have not come over to the side of democracy and freedom.
Yazov is in charge, is still controlling the military?
Well, it's very hard to tell, but according to Mr. Yeltsin, I've told you just exactly how it is working as of right now. I would say that he, as far as what Mr. Yeltsin knows, which is what I know, that the defense is not over on the side of Mr. Yeltsin at this point. Yeah, we're going to work our way right down here.
Mr. President, with Boris Yeltsin anchoring Democratic opposition to this coup, where does that leave him if things do in fact resolve themselves satisfactorily?
It leaves the world looking at him as a very courageous individual, duly elected by the people, standing firmly and courageously for democracy and freedom with enormous stature as a result of that.
Would that change the U.S. approach toward Mr. Yeltsin?
The U.S. approach towards Mr. Yeltsin, as you know, is to be supportive of those who were elected. Ever since he's been elected, he has received total support, and before he was elected, he was received properly. And but I must say, in terms of the respect level, I will join others all around the world, not just politicians or elected leaders of countries, in saying that he has shown tremendous courage, and the people appear to be rallying behind him. And as I said earlier on, to some skepticism 48 hours ago or more, that look, all these coups don't succeed, and democracy, once unleashed, is a pretty powerful force. So I think he will have a well-earned stature around the world that he might not have had, that it was on his way to having, but might not have fully achieved before all this happened, provided it works out the way certainly the United States wants it to work out. But it is too early to declare these matters over. I don't want to be a part of that.
How about Mr. Gorbachev's position, sir?
Well, who knows? I mean, we can't even get in touch with Mr. Gorbachev, but Yeltsin is strongly supporting him. And so are we. He was constitutionally empowered. And that's the point here. And every time I talk to Yeltsin, or both times I've talked to Yeltsin, he makes this point of strong support for Gorbachev. Yeah.
President, are you planning any additional steps today? And have you given any additional instructions to Ambassador Strauss about what he should do?
No, he will be in touch with me probably later today, and in touch with the Secretary of State. I'll be... I missed a call, I think, from Jim Baker a few minutes ago, but he's over in Brussels. He will have met with the NATO leaders. I expect we may see him up here tomorrow, and we can get a little more detail out of that one, but I don't know the exact details of the Strauss plans yet. He just got there. He's surveying the situation, as I asked him to do, and its developments are happening so fast that I'll just have to wait and see how the clock runs and what he has to say.
President Yeltsin's reports on the activities of the Special Forces and other military units, are they mirrored by U.S. intelligence on the subject, or do we have any U.S. intelligence?
Well, we have the best intelligence in the world, and sometimes it can accurately predict things, and sometimes it can actually count the beans and tell us the things you're asking about. We have some evidence of force movements in the Baltic area, but I don't want to go beyond that. Yeah.
Say that Yeltsin says there's a delegation from the Russian Republic en route to the Crimea hoping to see Gorbachev. What is your understanding of what they hope will happen? Do they want to bring him back to Moscow?
Absolutely. They want him back in power. He was constitutionally put into office, and they want to have the law fully observed. So they would like to see that, and they would like to see him in there unhampered by the illegality of the coup.
Can you give us any sense of whether they think that will be possible today, tomorrow? Anytime?
No, I can't, because he was understandably vague as to whether they would get to see Gorbachev. He gave me the names of the people that were on the flight, which I'm not going to give, because I think that should come from over there.
Mr. President, given the way the world, if you will, is wired for sound and pictures, it's conceivable that Gorbachev is hearing you right now.
I hope so.
Or will. Since you can't get through to him on the phone, what would your message publicly be to him?
I would say, stay with your principles, stay with your reforms, stay with your commitment to democratic process and constitutional law. Stand shoulder to shoulder with Yeltsin, as you have been in seeing the evolution of democracy and perestroika and glasnost in the Soviet Union. And knowing Gorbachev, I'm convinced he will. Knowing what the objectives of the coup plotters must be, I would expect they'd be trying to get him to do something else.
Sir, in your communications with the Soviet Union, have there been any assurances to the U.S. at any level that the Soviet nuclear arsenal is safeguarded, that someone can't get their finger on the button?
We see no reason to be concerned about that. Our people are taking a hard look at that all the time.
Sir, I know you're glad to hear Boris Yeltsin say that American support has been very helpful to him, but in fact, you've talked about the limited impact the U.S. can have. Your aides talk even more starkly about how little impact the limited economic aid we have, cutting off cultural exchanges. Is that the sort of thing that would have any impact on people, or these conservatives who are desperate to stay in power? Do you think you've had any impact?
Yes, I think I would simply go by what Mr. Yeltsin says. And the statement that I made yesterday, he was profuse in his gratitude for that. And others, not just the United States, but we are the United States of America, and thus with a disproportionately loud voice in matters of this nature. But John, all I can tell you is what the man says. I'll tell you what I said to him. I said, now, would it be helpful to have another statement along the lines of the ones I made yesterday? And he repeated, yes, yes, yes. It is very important. And so, you know, there's some people in this country from one side or another of the spectrum that we have that say you ought to be able to wave a wand and solve a problem of this nature in the city of Moscow instantly. That's not what you can do. But what you can do if you're president is put the full force of the American people behind, emotionally, morally, behind the Democratic forces. And that's what I'm trying to do. And apparently, according to Mr. Yeltsin at least, and I think others, that's what we should be trying to do.
Sir, these are pretty hard-boiled characters.
Yes, they are.
Plotted this coup. And, you know, moral pleas to them probably have very little impact. Do you think the fact that they fear this economic aid being cut off, not only by you, but by the EC countries, do you think that's the sort of thing that has an impact?
Well, I would think it would have, or I wouldn't have, you know, I would have done it anyway, but I think it would have. Yes, John, they've got economic problems. As you know, some of their first decrees were they were going to put food on the shelves and do something about medicine and do something about energy. As they see the reality of the world, they are going to need the help of the outside world. And when they see the United States and they see the European foreign ministers coming together, all saying they're not going to have business as usual, I think it does make an impact. And so that is one thing that can be done.
The apparent split in the coup plotters?
No, I think what caused the current split is in the coup plotters, and this is pure conjecture, is to some of them realizing sooner than others that they may have bitten off more than they can chew here. But time will tell on that one. And again, I don't want to be proclaiming this matter solved. I will say that once again that I am pleased it is moving in the direction that it appears to be moving. But they've got a lot of troops. They got a lot of force. They got a lot of people that look at these matters in a very hard line way. And the one thing I don't want to do is inadvertently contribute to their will and their resolve. But I think some are flaking off because they think that they've gone about it wrong. Yeah. Wait, I've already had one for you. Yeah. I'll be back though, Norm.
Assuming that President Gorbachev does recover his authority, how will this affect his ability to keep the Soviet Union on a stable path? Will he be strengthened by it or weakened?
I would say that, again, a little hypothetical for me to get into, but given Yeltsin's support for him and given the respect and that with which he's held by leaders all around the world, and that has certainly not been diminished by this at all, he will still be a force to be reckoned with. And again, they can sort out inside their own matters, but what will be filtered away should Gorbachev be reinstated, as we hope he will be, what will be filtered out will be the fear of a right-wing military takeover, because the people will see that the power of the people to stand up against this illegality is pretty good, pretty strong.
So in effect, that might indeed strengthen his hand to move in a...
It's possible, but again, it's too hypothetical yet. Look, we got a big problem out there, and I'd want to try to keep it as factual as possible.
President.